drug crisis and harm reduction. Sitroy spoke with them and fellow co-founder of the Alliance and social work professor Carmen Laveau during the fire. Laveau says as a harm reduction advocate, she feels discouraged to see this crisis enter its 10th year.
It's just so draining to see that as a community that we haven't really addressed this. And that it just continues on and every day people are dying and nothing's being done about it is deeply discouraging.
Brown says while they also feel discouraged, they see hope in a change with seeing people come out for the grief fire.
I really appreciate everyone that showed up in the rain, and we're here to acknowledge the lives lost from the toxic drug crisis. I'm encouraged by people around me right now because, nobody had to show up. We're all like a little cold and wet, but this has been a really good ceremony, and I hope that we can all celebrate and grieve together.
Nestor, who is newer to harm reduction advocacy, says it's hard to not be angry with how everything has gone.
There's been so much really great like research and political activism happening over the last several years, and it kind of just feels like screaming at a brick wall. That's one of the reasons we decided to do this instead of any sort of political event, though it is political just by virtue of being about drugs, is because we kind of need to focus more inwards now, maybe, because people are burnt out.
As the three are prepared to continue advocating in this space, Laveau says she does this work as it's important that the toxic drug crisis and the deaths caused by it are not normalized.
As a society, people don't even realize this is an issue, that we need to keep bringing these issues to the forefront as best we can so we don't become complacent to it. And I think to challenge the stigma too, because I believe that that's what underlies it all is stigma. So I think this is the best way we can do it, is to gather publicly.
As a professor, Laveau says she sees hope in the students she teaches, who are better educated and interested in harm reduction. Nestor says what needs to be done is a major shift in public opinion, something they believe is happening.
The political side, it's not getting better anytime soon. But I do think the public opinion is shifting. I think that the media coverage I've seen in like the last 6 months of the toxic drug crisis, people are becoming more aware of it. Harm reduction is definitely becoming more normalized just because people know. So that's my hope, is that even if things are very slow to change politically, if they're going backwards, that people will start to care. I think they are.
Since the start of the public health emergency in 2016, more than 18,000 people have died in the province due to the toxic drug crisis. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning.
On April 14th, 2016, the province of BC declared a public health emergency. It's been 10 years, and we are still in a public health emergency with no end in sight. Thanks to Denny Nesvadarani and Pamela Hasen and Lauren McKenzie for those reports. I hope we're not back here in 10 years marking the 20th anniversary with the crisis still in the same, just as bad as it is now. But it's an extraordinarily difficult problem to address, and I think the lack of progress that we've seen speaks to that. And obviously lots more needs to be done to try and figure out what the solution is. Thanks to our reporters there for those reports, and thanks to the many, 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 many people working to address the crisis every day in so many different capacities. It is difficult work, and we can only hope things get better. Peter's up in about 10 minutes, right, Peter?
Yeah, that's correct.
We're going to be talking about art.
I'm going to qualify the what the involvement of the CIA was in abstract expression. I'll qualify it with a few.
All right, so we'll be talking about that. First, we have a bird note, and then we're going to go straight into gardening with Embark. We're going to be talking about container gardening this week. oh, whatever. Does not seem that Bird Note is working properly for us. All right, well, we'll head to this instead. All right, sorry, a little bit. We'll get this smoothed out, and there we go.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to two.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Bird Note. There are many great tools for identifying birds. Some of them are right on your phone. Apps such as Merlin Bird ID from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology can help suggest which species you're seeing or hearing. If you're stumped on an unfamiliar plant species, iNaturalist is a great resource. When you upload a photo to iNaturalist's website or mobile app, it uses AI to make an educated guess on the species ID. Then, a worldwide community of volunteer naturalists helps confirm the ID or propose alternatives. Combining AI with on-the-ground human knowledge makes iNaturalists highly accurate. Once you put a name to the plant you found, consider searching for more info about that plant. For example, which birds might eat this plant's seeds or fruits? Which birds can use this plant as a nesting spot? Finding the links between plants and birds can show you how birds see the world and what they need to survive and raise their young. And that can make you better equipped to help them in the future. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel. This episode is brought to you by Wild Delight Bird Food, which aims to support wild bird populations with clean, nutritious ingredients in every blend. Available at Chewy.com.
Welcome to Gardening with Embark. And joining me in the studio here is Pablo Vimas, Embark Sustainability, our gardens expert who joins us every week.
Hi, good morning, everyone.
Yeah, to talk about things, plants and gardens and soil and water and everything you need to know about
growing food.
Growing food.
Yes, that's what we do here at Embark Sustainability. We are very much focused on growing food and help everyone to develop skills to grow food. Yeah. So last week we talked about the weather, and this week has been something the same. Rain.
Yeah.
But if you are a gardener, you might have heard about us talking about access to a community plot garden, access to a plot in a community garden, gardening in your front yard, in your backyard, yeah, or coming to garden here in campus where we provide the space and the resources and tools to garden.
Yeah.
But what about if you have no access to those areas, mm-hmm, where you can do some gardening? So today we will be talking about container gardening. So gardening in the smallest space that you have, like a patio, a balcony, a windowsill.
Right.
So that would be the approach that you still can grow food and enjoy the...
And in smaller containers.
Well, yeah. So when we do container gardening, yeah, we have containers that... The container could be anything. Mm-hmm. As long as offers a good drainage.
Yeah.
So if there is no drainage holes, we might need to drill some, four or more holes spaced regularly,
yep,
and at least 1/4 inch wide.
Yeah.
So the water really drains. And the diameter of the pot could be between 6 and 10 inches diameter. and the height of the pod between 6 and 8 inches high. So those are the pods that we're looking for. So we are talking about between 3 to 5 gallon pods.
Right.
Yeah, so so anything that is this size, it will provide good space for a plant's roots to develop and to produce beautiful vegetables.
Yep.
So the pots, so if you have any container, will do it as long as there is drainage holes. You have pails from the painting, painting pails, the buckets that you can use that. There are 5 gallon buckets, so we can use that. So once you have your containers, we need to fill them with some kind of medium. We don't use garden soil because garden soil is very heavy.
Right.
And as you have your garden, you will try to... the benefit of having a container garden is that it's a mobile garden. So if you know that in the morning the sun warms up you a part of your garden, and in the afternoon it warms up another part of the garden.
Right.
If you have you are at home, you can move with the pot from one side to the other side. So it's very mobile, yep. But it has to be light.
Yeah.
Also, we can have hanging baskets. If we put regular soil, it would be too heavy.
Right.
No. So, so it has to be light soil, which usually is the potting mix, soil potting mix that we will be using.
So. Just quickly, what would be the difference in the composition between your regular soil for your in the ground garden or your large box garden?
Yeah, so as we talk here, we use engineered soil, which is the mixture of, mix of manure, rotten manure, compost, sand.
Yeah.
So the sand will be very heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the soil mix, the potting mix will be materials like perlite. Retains oxygen, vermiculite that retains water, and we move from peat moss to coconut coir as a filling material, and then compost, very light compost. So that will be the way. And of course, we have now a slow release fertilizer, which is a little marbles that are all spread into the mix. Because we are using soil, so there is no sand in there.
Yeah.
So the whole mix is very light. Yeah, so that's the difference. One is more manure, compost, and sand, while the other is coconut coir, vermiculite, perlite, that is very light materials, plus fertilizer. That makes easier to move your pots and also allows a good drainage. So now you have your pots, the size, as I said, 3 to 5 gallons, 6 to 8 inches tall, filled with beautiful soil. Before filling your pots, make sure that there is a layer of at least 1/2 inch at the bottom with gravel to help to drain the excess of water. So what usually we do here in our vertical garden, because we have our vertical garden in campus, what we have done is to put marbles or gravel at the bottom of the pot, our landscape fabric, and then comes the soil. So we still have this gravel working as a drainage layer.
Right, and the landscape fabric keeps the soil from sort of going down and filling all the gaps.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's the idea, to keep separately the two substrates. So the water drain, and as well there is a way that oxygen gets into the soil as well.
Yeah.
You know, keep nicely. So that's very much with the, as well, because you have different size of pots, you can not only organize them horizontally, you can go vertically.
Yeah.
So that's why we have container vertical garden now. So from container garden, you're moving to a container in organizing a vertical position, so you can optimize your space that you have.
Right.
Then you can choose your vegetables. So the vegetables, for instance, lettuces, will do very well in a 1 gallon bucket or container. So you can put 4 to 6 lettuces in 1 gallon.
Oh, okay.
You can grow one cabbage, one broccoli or cauliflower in 1 gallon of container. If you want a bit larger plants like tomatoes, you will need 3 gallons container. And as well, if you like to grow potatoes, using the right determinate variety, you can do in a 5 gallon container.
Right.
So, yeah, so these are, and it's smaller than 6 inches is, we have to be careful not to use, because this soil, this tends to, we need to keep them moist. and prevent they dry out. So that one thing that we container gardening is that they tend to dry out very quick.
Right.
So sometimes we need to water daily, or more often than we do in the community garden. So because the soil dries up quickly. So the one thing is to prevent that the soil dries out completely, because the plant will stress. And if it's a fruit plant like a tomatoes, the tomatoes will just drop. Mm-hmm. The plant will just drop the tomatoes. And if you are growing for flowers, or the flowers are being set in order to make pots, the flowers will drop. And yeah, so this is a, so we shouldn't let the soil dry out completely, so the plant stresses out. Yeah. So we need to keep watering.
And those, like, often when you pick up some plants from the, like, ones, not necessarily seedlings, but a little more, they're already in a 6-inch pot, and you really should be repotting that pretty
quickly. Yeah, you should be repotting that. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you should be repotting to a 1-gallon container. Right. And that's where we need to, you know, these roots are in a small space. There is very little soil where they can extract the nutrients for growing. So we need to add some fertilizer, a liquid fertilizer. Now there are lots of organic fertilizer like a kelp, like seaweed, that we can add to this pots once we are watering, and so that's how it was. So now you have your beautiful pots growing beautiful vegetables, and tomatoes and beans try to use varieties that are short, or determinate variety for the tomatoes, and the bush beans, because they are small. One thing that we have to prevent is that the plant gets so tall that the above the ground gets too heavy that everything can just topple. Right. When there is a strong wind, the container is not heavy enough, so the whole plant just goes into the ground. Right. So with the tomato plants, we need really to be on top of pinching and remove any side shoot. So we have to choose two main stems that they're going to produce and keep nice and pinched, so you can organize the way they grow. But yeah, we cannot do like we do in the garden. They, you know, just leave the plant get all bushy, all tall, and then we put the sticks in here and there.
Yeah.
In container garden, you need to be mindful that the above ground is not too heavy to topple the whole plant, the whole pot. And the summer, we are going more to summer, so the summer care is water the soil, not the leaves. another thing. Water, no. You can water in the morning at noon if you water the soil. Try to avoid watering at night, because if the leaves or the plants get wet, they won't dry out quickly, and at night, so they will most likely get some plant diseases that we don't want.
Right.
So, yeah, so that's with the maintenance, and just keep fertilizer. That's the one thing that many gardeners ask me sometimes, like, what I do with this potting soil at the end of the season. Well, you can get new soil, potting soil, and mix it. But as you continue using fertilizer, organic fertilizer, to feed the plant, there is no reason to throw your material, because you still can reuse it.
Right.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's pretty much with what we will do with container gardening. So if you are into a small area, having a small space, and the other beauty of container gardening is if you grow herbs.
Yeah.
You can take those pots indoors during the fall. So on winter, most of the pots are inside.
Mm-hmm.
So you will have your parsley, your rosemary, your thyme growing indoors. And when the spring comes, you move them back to the outside in the garden. So
And those are mostly perennial plants. So as long as you look perennial. After them, they're going to keep on rolling.
Yes, as well with the mint. I mean, if you like mint, you just keep in your small pot being inside during the winter, and you still enjoy your herbs.
Excellent. Well, that's great advice, and of course, for many of us, that's our most successful form of, or accessible form of gardening. So those are some great tips, Badlo.
Oh, yeah. Happy to share.
Thanks for joining us today. Tell us a bit about Embark and your programs.
So Embark is a nonprofit organization directed by students for students. We are based here in the Student Union building. We manage two vegetable gardens, two learning gardens. One is in the third floor of the Student Union, and one is in the south side of the Maggie Bankston Field. We focus on two streams, climate change and food justice, and growing food connects both of our streams. At the moment, we are calling for people who can help us for the food rescue program that we run every Thursday in the afternoon. And as well, we are already calling for people who is interested in doing the summer gardening cohort. Yeah. We start on May 7th, and we meet for 7 weeks. And during that 7 weeks, we continue cultivating our plot and developing our gardening skills. So if you're interested in joining us, visit our website, embarsustainability.org, or our social media channels at embarsustainability.
And with that gardening cohort, that's a really, you know, you can listen to our podcast here, our talks every week, and learn a lot, but you're going to, for those folks, they're going to get hands-on in the garden.
Correct. Yeah, they get hands-on, and we have one-to-one talks, and we answer questions, and we have a group of 10-minded people doing the gardening, yeah. So it's as well growing part of a community that are interested in growing food. Yeah.
Great opportunity to get a life skill, so follow up with Pablo through their socials and their website and get involved.
Looking forward to hear from you.
Thanks for joining us this week, Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability.
Yeah, see you next week.
See you next week. And Peter.
Okay, so what it really is that the Museum of Modern Art.
So just to introduce, yeah, and keep people just tuned in, we're talking about
this idea that the CIA pushed abstract expressionism.
All right, set us up.
The best way of looking at it is that the Museum of Modern Art, owned by the Rockefellers, are very controlled by the Rockefellers, created by the Rockefellers, really put the situation where the surrealist movement fizzled out, and abstract expressionism for a while was the modernity, and in many ways it still is. Now, Andy,
so if you could characterize what is abstract expressionism in like two sentences, if that's even possible, just so if people don't know, what is it?
It is a painting which is not representative even by accident.
Right.
In fact, to kind of back up Jackson a bit. Now, one thing I won't back him up was when he urinated into a fireplace when the fire was there.
Is this Jackson Pollock?
Yeah.
Okay.
He supposedly did this. And I don't plan to do it myself. And
I hope not.
He, you know, his little dribble thing, he would sometimes find he accidentally had a representational thing in the thing. So he'd make an effort. At one point, he went back to representational close to the end of his life, or kind of a weirdo kind of representational, actually. Yeah. But anyway, so he would say, oh, this is representational. I have to alter it. So that is basically what abstract art is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, abstract expressionism is a type of abstraction because neoplasticism, now I don't think our younger viewers remember the Partridge Family.
Probably not.
But their bus was actually designed with that thing about the checker thing or whatever it was.
Right.
That was a neoplasticist artist who did that type of painting. And that was the 1930s. And that was when surrealism was the art movement. But
right.
Abstraction had happened previously.
Yeah.
Now, according to the theory, abstract expressionism is either action, which is Jackson Pollock, or field, which is Barnett Newman, which this autobiography of Jackson Pollock, which came out in 1989, makes to be the biggest clown of them all. And in the 2 years from then, the National Gallery of Canada bought the, you know, but it's only three stripes.
Right.
So that's field. Right. And by the way, a house painter would be a bit better than Barnett Newman because...
So you have sort of two things there, though, with like the field, which is kind of like patterns of sort. And
field is not patterns as such. That's not...
Patterns, but fields of color, let's call it that.
Yeah, fields of color.
Whereas Jackson Pollock is very expressionist in the sense it's...
Yeah.
It may not be representative of anything specific, but it does often capture a lot, sometimes emotion and stuff.
So what it was, Barnett Newman was the epitome of field. And the one we have in the National Gallery, unfortunately, is sort of the rectangle, like in 2000 when a Space Odyssey monolith. Usually he did it the other way, the rectangle. the other way around, like the long is on the vertical or on the horizon, as it were, and then he just has little fields. Pretty simple, I would say. Interesting in this book, the 1999 book, the autobiography of Jackson Pollock, him and Barnett Newman had this relationship. It was probably Barnett Newman that told Jackson Pollock, you can't even be representational by accident. Right. But one part of the book, which is in there somewhere, but I'll just paraphrase it. It was that they would see Jackson Pollock be going, just pounding on the desk with all this, and Jackson Pollock would just be looking at him entrenched. And people would say, were you paying attention to that? Oh, no, I was just interested how he was doing it. And so that's it. Okay, I'm going to tell you the CIA involvement.
Okay.
So the Museum of Modern Art was started by a wife of one of the Rockefellers. I think it was John D. Rockefeller. Yes. And their building they're still at was 1939, and the Rockefellers donated the space and all that. Right. Nelson Rockefeller got a position in the Museum of Modern Art, and then he was, of course, involved with COVID action as the one of the people with the Museum of Modern Art. Mm-hmm. And what happened was there was an obviously government-funded art show, 1947, and a Look magazine, which was Life. The Life magazine used to have a competition. It was Look.
Right.
And they sort of...
And they were sort of like, I think, weekly pictorial magazine,
yeah,
full of
but they,
photos.
But they
stuff.
Questioned it very strongly. And then they said, oh, we got to be a bit more under the table, sort of thing. So basically what happened was that during the 1950s, the CIA helped fund some art critic publications. They didn't have their art critics doing it,
yep,
but it was some international ones, about five of them, during the 1950s. And there were international showings of Jackson Pollock, even after he had died, and included international things of Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah.
And Louis Armstrong.
Yeah.
And then Louis Armstrong found out in the early 60s he didn't want to be a dupe because he was concerned about the Congo during the early 60s. So he kind of said...
Because there was a big war there, Civil
yeah.
War.
But he was war. He was part of these funded tour groups that included painting and musicians. And Louis Armstrong kind of got wind of it, and then he kind of buckled. He said, no, I don't want involvement with this. Now, it was around 1966, supposedly, that it became kind of known, but very much in niche circles. And then it, over the years, it's gotten to even Stephen Fan knows about it now. But I see, this is, I'm kind of qualifying basically
yeah.
what had happened.
Yeah.
Now, for example, the Rockefellers have been criticized in...
But we only got like a minute and a half, so what did the CIA do?
Well, what I basically told you.
Okay.
Anyway, I was just saying that a lot of people are critical how the Rockefellers have controlled the medical establishment.
Right.
In much the same way. And they controlled the artistic movements as well. I mean, the Museum of Modern Art is sort of just... was where they put modernism because it was in Europe, of realism, cubism, and so on. And when you catch a butterfly, you basically pin it down and it stops being alive, I guess. So that's what I have to say.
Well, that's awesome. A fascinating bit of art history there.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that to us today, Peter. This has been... Speak Up for this Monday. Thank you for joining us today. Do you know what you're going to talk about next week, Peter?
Who knows? I'll figure out something.
Okay. Are you going to do that interview, though?
Yeah, but that's going to... Well, you know, they're pretty antiseptic, all this abstractness. It might wait for 2 weeks.
So, yeah. So, anyway, Peter's going to do an interview with Paul Klee Gallery?
Paul Kyle.
Paul Kyle. Okay. Well, now we're out of time. Thank you for tuning in today. Democracy Now! Is coming up in just a few seconds. Stay tuned for a lot more great programming here on CJ.